Can you finally afford to own that Ferrari F40, Bugatti Veyron or McLaren F1? Well, the man to my right is going to tell us just how you can do that. Stay tuned, this is going to be a great one.
Buying or selling a classic car? Head to historics.co.uk or click below for a free valuation.
Hello and welcome to the Historics Vidcast here at the Historics HQ. Now, before we get started, please do remember to like and subscribe to these podcasts and to our YouTube page. Without your subscriptions, we can't keep making them. So please do go there, click like and subscribe and the bell icon if you want to be reminded. So today, I've got our very own classic car geek, Fraser, consigner. But to my right is David. Now, David is part of the car crowd. Now, you're the owner and founder, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I founded it in 2019, yeah.
Lovely. And you're going to tell us exactly how we can own parts of cars and invest in our money and our cars. So let's go straight into that.
Yep.
Tell us about the car crowd.
So the car crowd is a platform that we've developed to allow people that love cars to join together to own cars. So the platform itself effectively gives a digital way for you to own a real stake or a real share in a car, whether you want to use that car for track day purposes, you want to join together with some mates to own a supercar, or whether you want to do that for investment purposes and own a fraction of a car, and obviously as that car appreciates in value, potentially your share price goes up as well. We try to provide a range of ways for people who love these cars to be able to get closer to them, because a lot of cars are appreciated kind of out of range, and not many people can get the money together to be able to buy the whole car. So, investing fractionally gives them a way of accessing the classic car market with potentially without having that huge capital outlay.
So this is a bit like stocks and shares, but with that tangible asset that you can relate to.
Yeah,
on a car enthusiast.
Yeah, on the investment side, certainly. So the investment business works basically, it's like investing in any limited company. So a limited company, we set it up using the platform that buys the car outright, and then we just effectively fractionalize or have shares available in that company. And because that company owns that one asset, that's the only risk effectively is whether that car goes up or down in value.
Yep.
Obviously, there's no guarantees for future appreciation, but classic cars have been a strong performing asset class for a number of years. But they tend to be out of reach because you have to have 50,000, 60,000 to buy the car, store the car, maintain the car, insure the car. So a lot of people can't get access to them. There's some boring numbers, but about 80% of ultra high net worth people have a classic car, an alternative asset in their portfolio, whereas only 13% of normal investors do. And that's just because of that fact that it's just been inaccessible for so many years.
Actually, it's a good point you make as well about the storing and maintenance, because you may be able to buy that asset, but there is a secondary part to that. It isn't like art. It is something that needs to be looked after, maintained. Mm-hmm. So having that share enables that to be split between them, so you can all have part of that. Now, so what sort of, so let's say me and Fraser, we've got a pot of money.
Yeah.
We want to invest in a car.
Yeah.
So we come along, we say, right, David, what do we do here? What cars have you got? So do you offer the car to the investor, or does the investor shop for the car? How does it work? Have you got a portfolio of cars that we can then invest in? Do you split across a number of cars, or do people tend to put it all into one car?
Yeah, so we on the fraction investment side, we do have a portfolio of cars that we bring to the platform. So our curation, if you like, process is steeped in quite a lot of data. Like you introduced, Fraser as a bit of a car geek, so that's where I am as well. I've been around cars since I was about 4 years old. So I've collected handwritten ledgers of prices from auctions going back to sort of 1990s when I used to go around with my dad. So, I've always grown up with these cars and sort of seen trends and stuff in my own personal life when I was collecting cars, around things like ones with big engines and manual gearboxes, first off production numbers, limited number motorsport homologations, stuff like that are the ones that seem to buck the trend and always kind of appreciate over time. We look to bring those sorts of cars to the platform. We try to catch them at the bottom of the curve, not at the top, obviously. If you're going out now and you're buying some of the sort of 70s or 80s cars, they might already be well at the top of their appreciation curve. So we look for the ones that are sort of more in that late 80s, early 90s phase now that are starting to come into the curves, like Escort Cosworth, for example, is a great one. 355 Ferraris, they've seen a lovely, in the teens percentage return each year on year for the last few years. And there's no guarantees, but the projection would be that would probably continue because they're in rare supply and high demand. We also look for things like cars that are going to be exported, 25-year rule
coming to America
in 2000s, and it was great. So, both Australia and America America have a very similar rule with that. Australia, actually, I think, have just also reduced the import tax as well. So any car over 25 years old not only is exempt from emissions, but also has no import duty. So people are just buying up, you know, as soon as they hit 25 years old. So anything around the 1998-99 production run, yes, like a Ferrari 550 Maranello.
There's a lot of the Japanese stuff as well.
Some of the Japanese stuff. Anything right-hand drive. So the Maranello is a great example because they made loads of them in left-hand drive, but very few, only 460 cars in right-hand drive. Obviously, V12 manual, Grand Tour are perfect for Australia, but they never had an allocation of them. I think they had 12 cars that some of the Ferrari dealers in Australia managed to nab off the Europeans.
Yeah.
So there's very, very few of them over there. And now they're hitting 25 years old, starting from October last year. The values of those have increased by 30% last year.
Yes, because the values were low.
They were low. They were like 60, 70K. Yeah. You know, now they're 120K probably average in the UK if you're looking online. So one sold fairly recently at 105, and they seem to be going up. And then in Australia, they've been listed for $260,000 to $350,000.
Because
they're in rare supply. So, that's the sort of stuff that we do, because that's what our day job, right? So we do that analysis, we talk about it in the office, we bore each other to tears, you know, talking about it and stuff. And then, you know, we try to consign, if you like, similar to curate those cars to bring to the platform. And then we'll divide them into a number of fractional stakes. We try to make that affordable. You know, we don't want to bring something and then say, oh, it's 10 grand minimum investment. You know, we start about £300 so people can get access to it. You have to have previous investment experience because it is deemed as a high risk investment. There is no guarantee that people will get returns, but we feel it's a very good asset backed investment that has good potential appreciation with a strong track record. And as you said right at the start, it's passion based. So people know about these cars, they understand them, and it's probably better than investing in someone.
Strangely enough, it's that sort of thing where for instance, you've got a pension pot. And your pension pot similarly is split across a number of different assets. There'll be certain higher risk and lower risk, and it's spread to make sure that it has a gradual growth.
Mm-hmm.
And similar with these cars then. So you'll have split across a number of cars. One may rocket in value, that will bring the fund up. There'll be a couple that bubble along, I guess, and that way it all sort of...
You can go, we've got 1960s E-Type, we've got right up to a 2007, I think, R26 Armaghan. You know, the range there is so diverse.
Yeah.
So we try to bring stuff that will buck the trend. You know, we look for the best classics, we look for ones that have got good heritage, good provenance, you know, good history. We always
If you've got a car and you're pitching its value, the trickiest thing, as we well know, is you can say that a Series 1 E-Type is worth that. But of course, as we all well know, it depends on the quality of the car.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it can be worth it.
You need to meet the quality of that expectation.
Absolutely.
Because it's like anything with data points. When we use, we use lots of different areas for data points for valuing cars. It's online, it's in person, it's knowing the car, it's experience. And then you can put that all together to sort of really skinny up where you think the estimate value for that car is.
Yes.
And then you can say, okay, so if our mean average of the car value is there, what you want to do is obviously pick a car that sits in that particular spot so that when it does move, it moves with that curve.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, I mean, we don't look for ones that have got, 16 miles on, for example, that have carried already 100% premium because they're a low mileage example, the refresher, the wrapper. And also because from the resale perspective for those cars, you're limited to only being able to sell them to other collectors because no one can use it. So we look for low mileage, good examples. I mean, the quote from William Haynes when we were doing the E-Type was, history drives provenance and provenance drives value. So if you can keep history and originality in a car, that's what drives the provenance of the vehicle, and the provenance therefore drives the valuation. So if you've got two like-for-like cars that look, one's nut and bolt restored and one's original, if you've got handwritten ledgers and all the original documentation and matching numbers and those things, that car will command 20 to 50% more than the one that's been restored.
We see a lot with E-Types now that have been converted to right-hand drive. You could have two identical cars and they might be worth £15,000 to £20,000 different. When really
it's the same car.
They're the same car.
The irony is you're looking for very similar factors in cars as we are when we're looking for how to sell cars to clients. And when you go in, we have the sad thing, we have to go and speak to people and manage expectations sometimes, whereby if they don't have that provenance or they don't have the quality in the car, they're looking at that mean figure and thinking, well, that's what my car's worth.
Yes.
And actually, you go this, and actually, that's what a car with this, this, and this, and this is worth.
Yeah.
You can have a better or a worse, and that's why we come along, we visit, and we also inspect.
Yeah, you have that tricky conversation, don't you? Which is, I know you think your type might be worth 120,000, but actually, it's.
What's made that more difficult? There's wonders of the internet whereby it's made certain parts of the job easier and certain parts of the job much, much more difficult.
Yeah.
Managing expectations, which isn't always a negative, it can be a positive.
Is
much more difficult because people they've got that expectation from the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, we've managed to be able to analyse far more data points than we ever would have done.
Mm.
We can know without going to every single auction on foot what every single auction has done.
Yeah.
We can obviously all see classifieds, which are always a bit difficult to to gauge, because, you know,
yeah, especially,
we can all put a car on for £1 million if it's worth £500,000. It doesn't sell.
I always think that with cars that are advertised, they're still advertised.
Right? Yeah, they're still on the market.
It's a good example, isn't it? Yeah, a sold price is the only real data point we can take.
I completely agree with
that. And we can never know for certain every single sold price, even though we will all have friends in certain industries.
Yeah.
You can get a feel, but no one really wants to give everything away.
No.
So it's difficult, because obviously that then becomes very, very intrinsic to your portfolio.
Yes.
There's no point.
Yeah, and I think with us, like, you know, we don't have to have that difficult conversation if the car's worth less. If people think, oh, actually, I don't think that car that they're advertising for investment is worth that, then they just don't invest, and that's fine.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Because again, it goes back to the fact that, you know, people have knowledge and passion on these. You know, we have,
and also you can't over, you know, you're FCA regulated. You know, you can't over. You're not trying to sell them. You're giving them the option.
Yes.
But they need to make their own decision.
100%. They need to qualify as an investor, and then they need to make their decision on it. And we present the data. We present the risk warnings and all the facts around the car. And we're very transparent. Everything's digitized. And you know, the biggest thing we get labelled with is, can we drive the cars? That's the biggest thing that people ask. And we'll come on, if it's okay, we'll come on to a sort of a drive product that we're launching soon. But at the moment, on the investment side, the answer is no, but there is like a motor museum concept, so you can come and visit the cars, and we encourage it, because we are so we've spent so much time and effort and love curating the cars that we want people to come and see
what they've fun, the funnest thing,
we want them to come and see.
Invest in Apple. They don't give you a discount on their phone, do they?
No.
Well, I mean, we say about property, right? So a lot of people have got potentially property portfolios. Yeah. So they might have flats and stuff. You don't live in every flat. You know, you don't go flat hopping.
No.
You know, you buy a portfolio of assets, like you say, to spread risk, diversify, and also to hopefully access an asset class that's fast returning and appreciating. So, you know, that's what we're giving people the opportunity to do with the fractional investment business at a much lower rate than has ever been available, because previously you have to buy the whole car, store the whole car, insure the whole car. No. So we hope that you know, people will use it as a diversification tool for their portfolio. We don't say get your cash, your pension out, and put it all in this, because you know you have to have a nice spread of risk. But we hope it's something different for people. And then on the drive side, because the platform allows people to join together to own a classic car, that one's for investment purposes.
Yep.
But actually, we've just started working on a concept for people to be able to join together with friends to buy a car and use it.
That'd because be popular.
There's no reason why not, right? So the barrier to entry for a supercar or a track day car or something like that, you know, could be you know, quite high. The risk of,
well, again, cost stores, of not only the car but the maintenance and the storage and so on and so forth.
Exactly. So if you can share that with four of your mates and you've got a bit of a community, especially I think for track cars, it would be great, you know, we can create a real legal construct behind that. So then even if you wanted to sell your stake because one of you is moving abroad or, you know, change circumstances, you could sell that stake to somebody else. And because it's all built in company law, you know, there's no risk to it.
Do you think you'd have to trust your mates, though?
Well, you wouldn't, but that's the thing. Previously, you would have to, right? You'd have to trust them.
Legal.
But this is legally done.
You know, if you all get to drive it, Fraser's got a really heavy right foot, and I'm quite gentle. I see, you say, oh, no, Fraser's going to take it.
You've got to pick your mates, haven't you? Yeah. Don't let Ledford drive it.
Even if people have access to all the money for a car, they've got a group of four friends that then could give them access to four cars.
Well, exactly, four friends, four cars.
And this
right?
also brings back
to the weekend.
Everything in classic cars is also, you know, the more you are with friends and enthusiasts, the more you enjoy it. On your own, it's such an amount of fun, but not that much fun.
Yes.
If you're with friends, then equally, then immediately it becomes much more enjoyable.
Yeah. And I think Fraser's point there is exactly right. We see people at Cars and Coffees and they're in like a small car club and they might have a McLaren, a California, one of them's got an old Nova car we've got, and then one of them's got an Aston V12 Vantage. So it's four quite different cars in terms of the way they're handling stylistically, but they each own one, but they actually pay for insurance to swap the cars every so often.
Yeah.
But again, then it's complete trust because there's no legal agreement between them. It's just a case of
they're
maybe they're insured and they're good mates. But actually, if you could do that and say, well, I own a quarter of all four of those cars and every other weekend I drive a different one. You know, you actually get access to more cars and you're still outlaying, if you like, the same capital with the same amount of maintenance costs, etc. So we're developing this drive product in order to try and help people do that. We aimed it originally at track cars and race cars, people joining together to own an iconic race car. But actually, we're working on looking at the supercar side of things as well, because I think actually it could lower that water level for people to get into a really nice supercar.
Yeah. Do you find some of your customers that invest are the similar customers with regards to the drive? Or
yeah,
is it completely different?
No, I mean, it used to be. When we first started the business, it was very much hobbyists type people. So people that were put, because we started at sort of £50 investment level. So it was very much a case of, you know, people that were almost using it like, you know, like a raffle ticket type business. You know, but that's not the aim of the business. No, it is an investment product. So we wanted to up that water level a little bit to make sure we had more considered investors coming onto the platform. And what we've done there is we've accessed this kind of, I mean, we call them the mass affluent population, but it's people that have got, you know, a decent sized income with a bit of money. We're not talking multi. But
yes, we said this before actually, because there's no point in getting, you know, Miuras, F40s and all this in your portfolio, because those buyers tend to be people that can go and afford to
probably
buy those themselves.
Yeah.
So there is a sort of a point in which you want to get to that middle ground where people are aspiring to a car, couldn't quite get there, and therefore can get into this rather than necessarily. I mean, it's great if someone wants to come in and say, actually, I'm going to spread my portfolio and I don't want to have one in my garage.
Yeah.
But if you can afford one, you probably go and buy one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at that level, if you're ultra high net worth, you do. But I mean, again, and because we have the curation expertise and the network access, you know, we also do offer a fund, you know, a traditional fund, which is minimum 100k investment. So there is the ultra high net worths can, you know, own a portfolio of cars, but then they don't get to choose which car like they do in the fractional business because the fund manager chooses the cars. And then, you know, we also have the managed portfolio service that we do as well. So people, if they have, you know, wanting to protect the wealth for future generations, a classic car is a fantastic way to do that because you can be sensible how you manage your liability for inheritance tax if you own a classic car.
Yes.
They're not all tax exempt from inheritance tax, but if you have a heritage significant vehicle, it can be, and we know what the criteria is to be able to select those. So we have some clients that, you know, effectively are looking to use classic cars as a way to protect their wealth for future generations as well. So we deal with ultra high net worth millionaires that, you know, have 16 houses across 16 different places and you can never get hold of them, through to people that come to the storage unit, you know, on a kind of weekly basis to look at the Peugeot 205 GTI that they've put 500 quid into.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, you know, we like them all, of course, but I really enjoy talking to people about the cars and taking them through the portfolio and the people that use, you know, have the passion for the asset class, because I think they're just such a, you know, such a variety, such a mix of amazing things that you can, you know, see, touch, smell with classic cars.
I think that's the key, isn't it? It's a bit of a see, touch, smell. You know, anything else you do, and I've, like everyone, hopefully you've got your pension scheme started, but you haven't got a clue, really. You know, you can log on once a year and go, well, that's what it's done.
No idea.
Half the time it's around the world and you just rely upon someone very learned to do it for you. But actually you haven't really got a clue what's going on. And as I said, you can do stocks and shares, but, you know, it's dead to you. You can have as many shares as you like in Apple. They're not going to do anything for you. You're not going to go and walk in the building and say, hello, I'm your boss.
No absolutely not. And you're trusting other people to run a company, aren't you? I mean, that's the thing. With all you're trusting with this is that the car crowd store that car well. And again, you know, we've got dehumidified storage unit up in Nottinghamshire.
You get the choice of the cars you invest in as long as
you get to choose.
It's me choosing, I think that car.
Absolutely.
I've all got the potential to rise in value. Mm-hmm. So if I put my investment in across those three, it's my choice. I think I know what's best.
Yeah.
I might be wrong, probably will be. But that way then you've got that sort of feel of control and involvement.
So about control, how do you decide when you're going to sell it?
Well, we open it to the shareholders. So one thing we were really passionate about is no one person can take more than 10% in the fractional cars, because we didn't want one person to control the asset. And then after 2 years, we have a fixed period of 2 years, just to give the chance for the car to appreciate.
Yeah.
And then we, every year after 2 years, we do a valuation of the car, a market report, and then you have a vote amongst the shareholders. So it's a normal limited company vote because it's using limited company law.
Yeah.
So it's a majority shareholder kind of wins. So, you know, we had one vote already back in June last year to sell the Renault Clio V6 that we had that made 30 odd percent in a single year. I think net return was about 24% after all the fees to the investors. They got
just
an offer.
Just to quantify that, so it's a 24% rise in that.
Yes, so it went from, we including fees, it was 30K. So I think we paid 28K for the car plus 2 years storage was $2,000. And then we had someone come to a Cars and Coffee event who'd always wanted a Clio V6, whose son had actually invested in the car. So he came with his son. And he was like, that's the one I've been looking for.
He bought it.
It was the right price, low mileage, but really good history. And he bought it. Well, he offered. He made an offer at the Cars and Coffee. We then put that onto our voting platform to let the shareholders vote. And we said, he's offered £38,000. Do you want to accept or decline? And it was 79% of the investors, I think, somewhere in there said yes.
So 24% and they made 24%. After the fees is...
After the fees, yeah, it was 32% gross, I think, 24%.
Yeah, pensions went up 7-8% every year.
That's
and
good.
That's a good term.
It was a great return for them, and there's no guarantees that you'll get
We've got to do that in every car, no pressure.
But that's it. To win it.
But the portfolio at the moment, across our 16 cars, we've got 1.2 million-ish of assets under management now, and across those, we're at 20% average rate of return.
Which is a high rate.
We've got the Renault Megane R26R, the best performing asset, nearly 40% director's estimate, so these are estimated valuations. Obviously, like we just said, you don't get a real valuation until you sell the car, but based on what's out in the marketplace at the moment and cars that have sold recently, the R26R is valued somewhere in the region of late 30s, early 40s now, and we bought it in the 20s. So,
and they're not getting any cheaper.
And they're not getting any cheaper. There's 191 sold out of 230 allocation. So they're so, so rare. We've got 13,000 mile to own a car. So, it goes back to that. Good history, good provenance. If you find the right car in rare, scarce supply, then if there's higher demand, then you're going to be hopefully onto a good combination.
I know, so that's very interesting how that can work. See, that's it. Yeah. You're starting to, I can see you're thinking. Cogs are spinning in his head there.
He's working out how much of his pension pot he can
get. Yeah. How old are you now, Fraser?
23.
So 23. So, and have you got a pension?
Yes.
Good boy.
He's a good man. He looks sensible, doesn't he?
Yeah, I didn't have much.
I mean, the average age on on the platform at the moment, the average age is 43, actually. Because we were expecting a lot younger audience. I mean, that's where originally we pitched it. I mean, you can see I'm wearing, you know, drippy skyline. You know, our merchandise and all our brand attitude is quite, you know, is sort of aimed at a millennial, I guess, audience, really. But we're sort of hitting the upper end of the millennials. You know, I'm in my 40s now as well. So that it seems like it is people of that age which actually get
it
the concept.
It maybe makes
and really
sense
like
as well.
It.
A lot of the people that are investing are in their 40s, which makes sense because they've missed the cars they aspired to, but yeah, we're even finding some of the much older cars.
Yeah.
On the flip side, they've probably had their time, and I think try not to invest in them.
You're quite right. There's that missing the boat, because often you come into that money in your 40s, but actually you should have done it in 30s.
Yeah. We
but
see
in 30s, you're too young to get there.
We see two spikes if you look at most car generations. So you've got pretty much a race to the bottom from a depreciation perspective for most new cars up until they're about 15 years old, and then they start to climb. A lot of them, if they're good marks and fairly rare, otherwise they just get scrapped. But they start to climb about 15 years, and then actually when you get to sort of 20 years old, those cars then become popular for the people in their 30s that liked them as teenagers. So they were 17 when they came out. They're now 37.
You tend to find people in their 30s are struggling for the money. They've just kids or they've just got new houses and so they've suddenly wrapped up in money. Yeah. And then just into their 40s, that's relieve a bit of pressure. And then, it's too late.
Yeah. Well, that's it. The boat goes, right? So from a car being about, somewhere in the region of 17, 18 years old up to about 25 years old, you see that quite strong appreciation curve for most cars in those things. So, you know, if we're looking back now, you're sort of looking at the late 90s stuff, like the Escort Cosworth, for example, was hitting 70, 80k. And then you get a second wave. So then sort of plateaus off a little bit, but then you get a second one around retirement age. So as you get into your 50s, and then it's the midlife crisis.
Well, we see a lot of that. That's what we deal a lot with, that sort of, because of the more classic cars, you do see an awful lot of that. Yeah. But I think what the top tip here, then, out of all of this is, you think about it in your 20s, but by the time you get to your 30s, make sure you've got some money in with something like the Car Crowd. Start to get those cars that you remember, and then you should be laughing in your 40s,
should be
shouldn't
your 40s,
you? Really?
And 50s, And then, but if you're still in one when you're about 60, you need to be selling it because it might drop off a cliff.
Right. So with all of that information in your brain, and it's cogs are whirling in phrases. Yeah. I know. Auction. Let's get back to auctions. We're right on the cusp of our Bicester auction when this airs. Mm-hmm. So back at Bicester for the second time. I actually really love that venue.
It's good. A lot of people are looking forward to it.
I think it'll be fantastic.
It's a nice place,
Bicester, it's just we're twinned now with Haggerty on insurance as well, and they've got their little clubhouse there. So
the next
one of these will be with Tom and Vicky in their clubhouse. As we sit now, it's about a quarter of the auction full.
Yeah.
By the time you look at this, watch this on YouTube and subscribe, of course, there will be a full auction catalogue. So go to the website, historics.co.uk, and you'll be able to see all of the lots. It will be, I think, probably in a week's time, so do come and join us. But you were telling me an interesting game you like to play with the auction catalogues. What is that?
It's so sad. So we get these prospectuses through post, obviously, being historics members. And in the office, they come through, and then we'll basically play a game of guess the estimate. So we split into two teams. And then we just randomly flick a page, say when to stop, and then you pick five cars on the page, unless it's a double page spread. And then you have to give it a brief description. So we always insist you have to give mileage, because mileage is the most important thing pretty much to value in the car. You have to give, obviously, right-hand drive, left-hand drive, a bit of information, the year, the make, the model, and that sort of stuff.
Bullet points come in handy then.
So we just read the top part, and then the sort of, you know, condition assessment as well. And then, you have to just guess, and you have to get into the range. And
I'm sure you don't get competitive at all.
Oh, it's massively competitive. And the losing team buys lunch. So,
blimey, so you can get expensive.
It can get expensive, yeah. It's definitely one of our favourite games.
So, Fraser, you've got another interesting car in this auction.
Yes.
And off the back of a car that we sold in the last auction, which always happens, of course. Mm. Someone else picks up the phone.
Yeah.
You got another Royal Link into a Range Rover.
Yeah, and this one's actually, we've got a photo of the Queen with the Range Rover, or near it.
near the Range Rover, okay.
The photo looks like she's walked out of it, you know, doors being shut. So
has it got some of those funny things? So the last one we sold, which we sold relatively well, actually, when you read the full description and everything was on the car, you're left thinking it must have been one of the cars up at Balmoral.
They don't have a log, they don't have a registration log.
Early doors, special vehicles order, which the last one had, and then they sort of disappeared. Of late, they're actually a lot more open about the cars they have. But back then they were a little bit more secretive. And traditionally on these Range Rovers, they had a specific pull handle so she could help herself in. She'd often have two window switches in the rear so that she could control the other window, because she'd obviously have her hats, she wouldn't want to do things like that. Yeah. There'd usually be special vehicle orders. Yeah. Sometimes
this one didn't have a parcel shelf because it had the dog guard.
Oh, yeah.
This one, I don't think it's got the double electric windows. Maybe they.
But we're never sure, because obviously there's lots of cars on those Royal Fleets.
I was going to say, they must have 50, 60 Range Rovers going at once.
Probably. Yeah. Of course, yeah. So the key on this one is obviously we're pretty certain she's sat in it because we've seen a photo of her, what looks like, disembarking.
Yeah, it was looked after by the factory for the first few years, servicing-wise. Had some services done up in Scotland, like the other one.
Okay. In September?
Yeah, it was in September, so end of summer.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But like I said, really the golden ticket is... There is a photo with the reg number, which we didn't have before.
And what does that do to the valuations then for those sorts of things? There's a provenance, because obviously the Diana
Series 2 Aristotle, we've always said provenance is the most difficult thing to really put a price to, because we don't value provenance, we value a car.
Sure.
So it's relatively subjective, but when you see things like the Diana Aristotle, we've sold a number of cars for the Quinn. We sold it at that X-Type for 30.
Yeah, and that was probably... That was probably five times its value, plus. So, and I think the Range Rover was probably three times its value. Yeah.
So you can see a huge uplift dependent on who's in. I mean, again, the Queen having been all the, you know, Elizabeth having been in it, I think probably some of the top royals all have a certain amount of kudos. Any Diana car has always done very particularly
so mystique
well,
around
to be
honest.
As is quite often the case, probably the same with the last Range Rover, the people who buy them don't tend to buy them knowing this. They buy it as a Range Rover.
Yeah.
And then do a bit of homework and suddenly
they realize
it's the best thing they ever bought.
Well, of course, it's like winning the lottery ticket, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, what about, so we're looking for a DB5 or DB6. I mean, the Royal Collection, is it maroon, I think, isn't it? It's convertible DB6 Volante. Yeah. I mean, that would be one of the most
iconic Aston Martins ever owned, because it's been so well scripted since.
And so well documented in media.
Exactly. So that would be, I'd say, again, looking at probably five times its value and upwards.
Yeah. I'd be amazed if that ever was ever available, though. Really.
Sometimes they just crop up, don't they? And then you think, where did that
go?
Can I find out where that was? Yeah. Please.
Start having dinner with the king more often.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just
get on his nice list.
So if you want to come and see that car, you must come down to Bicester. We're viewing on Thursday and Friday, so I'm sure you'll pop along in your subtle car. That'd be a great event. I think towards the end of the summer, and I think after what has been quite a good automotive summer, realistically, everything's back on the map.
Yeah.
It's a shame Goodwood got cancelled, but
I was there on the Friday.
Were you? So it was a Saturday ticket and missed it. What a bugger that was. So, but otherwise, I think it's been a good summer for that. It's a shame the weather hasn't kept up with it, but it's meant that we've all got to go out into our automotive events. So some of them are fine.
I mean, Supercar Fest was great. We've had some summer at least this year,
yeah.
And which has been good. And of course, post COVID, it's just nice to keep having the car show.
That's the thing. You just can remember. I spoke to someone that's an enthusiast club last week, and he said, last year was the first year that sort of they got back and it was a bit quiet. This year, everyone's got back into the swing of things.
Everything's set out, I think.
I've even noticed that with stuff we've been selling, actually. During COVID, people were paying lots of money for projects because they were stuck at home. Yeah. Now everyone's free to go and enjoy themselves. They just want a car that's ready.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've really noticed that.
Right. So auction talk over.
Yeah.
I have warned you guys. I'm going to have a little quiz. So
you gave me about 4 minutes.
I know. Yeah. So a little quiz to round off this podcast. Okay. Now, I'll do it sort of head to head. See how you get on.
No pressure.
Come on.
I don't think it's too hard. We'll find out. But I've got the answers in front of me, so it's easy for me, of course. So we have 8 questions.
Okay, cool.
Are we ready?
Yeah.
Number one.
Yeah.
Is this quick fire then, is it?
I don't know. Should we just confer and try and get the answer together? Because I think this is going to be so hard that neither of us are going to get it.
The earliest known use of the steering wheel was in what year?
In a car.
I said, we'll just do nearest the pin.
No,
nearest the pin.
You said earliest known use of the steering wheel in a car.
A boat.
Yeah.
Nearest the pin on this one.
I know they used to use some funny setups in the early days, but it's gonna be probably pre-1900.
I was gonna say it starts with an 18. I don't know what.
Go on then. Give us a date.
1874.
1872.
Have you seen my answers?
Oh, you're right.
Is that right?
It's 1894.
Oh, Fraser.
So previous,
I was gonna say that. But
back
I
to the boat reference. Previous to this, it was a tiller that steered a car.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well done.
Two.
What can I say?
I'm gonna retire now.
What was the first production car to hit 200 miles an hour?
I said XJ220, I think. It's probably
Ferrari F40.
It was the Ferrari F40.
Was it the 40 before the XJ220?
Yeah. Ferrari F40 was the first car to reach 200 miles an hour, first production car. Okay, what was the first commercially available car with twin turbo?
I think.
I did call Fraser a geek. Yeah.
It's good, isn't it?
A horrific amount.
Yeah. Unless there was something funny in the early 1900s when they were trying everything out, I think Maserati by Turbo.
Oh, he's got it wrong.
He's got it really? Wrong.
Yeah, go on, any other guesses?
Really? No, go on.
Porsche 959.
I was going to say 959. Was it 959? I was going to say 959, but I thought that was too late.
There you go.
He was talking about early 1900s. I'm like, oh, I must have missed a boat.
I'll give you half a point then.
Was it?
I was going to say 959.
So, next one. Okay, and the same things. What was the first production car to break 300 miles an hour? This is quite recent, so we should.
Yeah, well, production car.
Production car. Okay. Was that the, what's the American one? Not the Saline.
I think first production was probably the Bugatti Chiron.
Or the Chiron.
Yeah.
It was the Chiron.
I thought it was too obvious.
Super Sport 300 Plus.
What was the one that Shmee picked apart? There was some guy doing a video of
Hennessy.
The Hennessy, that's what I was thinking.
And I think they sped the video up.
They sped the video up, yeah.
Cheeky.
It was a bit of landing on the moon, isn't it? Okay, so next one. I think you both should get this one, actually. What year was the first official 24 Hours Le Mans?
They had the 100th anniversary this year. So... 1923.
Yeah. There you go. I'm glad you both got that one. Yeah. I'd be disappointed with both of you.
I just followed Fraser, to be honest.
Left of centre. What year did the first drive-in movie theatre open?
Oh my God. I think 50s America, I'm going to say.
It's late 40s, early 50s.
Go on, pick a year each.
48.
1933.
Wow.
So a little earlier. Yeah. You got that one then again. So.
Yeah. Pre-war.
And then what was the first car to break the sound barrier? This might be a little bit more our era than Fraser's, but...
Not the... Is it like Thrust 2?
Thrust SSC, I think. Yeah, big Thrust SSC. Had like the... jumbo thrust. Jet engines, didn't it?
I love half point for Thrust.
And then I didn't realise this, and I should have known this. I've recently sold one. What was the world's first all-aluminium car?
All alibodied.
Again, I bet...
This will surprise you if you don't know that off the hat.
I think it was Audi something, unless they were, unless there was something really not wacky Audi. In the early days. No?
Not a Jaguar. It not be the primitive Jaguar.
It was the Honda NSX.
NSX?
Well, the E-Type was way before that.
But wasn't all aluminium aluminium
cars? Well, the aluminium cars were.
Mm. Well, yeah, but that's not production. That would have been
special. Oh, sorry, it's a race car, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
NSX.
Yeah. I didn't realise that at all.
No, I thought I was thinking it was like an Audi.
I probably should put that in one of my catalogues.
Very, very fast appreciating classic, the NSX. If you can find a manual.
Yeah, that is the key now, isn't it? Finding manual cars.
They've got a 2JZ Supra, twin turbo, right-hand drive, UK car.
UK car manual.
I think there's probably about nine.
Yeah.
Left.
Yeah. Like unicorns now, original. Aren't they?
And they've all been chopped up. And
ours is completely original. Yeah. You've got the original calipers on it.
Though it probably feels underpowered compared to the 2,000 brake horsepower ones you find.
Well, yeah, that's true. But you know what? That car holds its own. I mean, it's close to 300 horsepower, but they inline turbos, you know, progressive drive. It's really good for a 90s car. It's amazing.
So I think they all agree. All the Japanese companies agreed on a 280 something horsepower. Cap, yeah, I think there was a law behind it.
That's why the UK spec Supras are 40 horsepower more than the JDM cars.
Yeah. Because when I first drove this by the Skyline, I thought, there's no chance, this is 280. It was too quick for that. And they all agree on a number.
Put a number in there.
Put a number in there. Don't tell anyone.
Keep it under a tax bracket or something.
Right, so just out of that, just as you know, I think you crushed it on that one.
Oh, I think Fraser. I'm not even...
Having spent time in the office with him, I'm not surprised.
Yeah,
he's that person you should take along to a quiz night, really.
Yeah, yeah.
As long as it's about cars.
Yeah, if it's not about cars, don't bother. Dead weight.
He sits in the corner and says, now we've got a car section. Fraser, in you come. The rest of it's Dom. Dom's great on general knowledge or just useless knowledge.
Yeah, all the water boys specifically.
Yes. So. Let's wrap that up. Thank you both. That was very interesting. Please, again, make sure you visit and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're also on Instagram, where you'll see all of the cars as we consign them. So please do go there. If you do want to see all of the lots for this current auction, which is next week, we think, it is all on historics.co.uk. And if you want to come down and see us, there's even the shopping centre at Bristol down the road. You can get rid of the other half if she doesn't like cars. You can come and see the cars.
Or him if she likes cars.
Yes, exactly, always.
This day and age.
So if you're missing out from consignment's point of view, because obviously we'd have closed for Bicester, we are now open for the Mercedes-Benz World Sale at the end of the year. That's in November, so please do give the sales hotline a quick call. If you want to follow us on socials, we're at Historics Auctions. I'm at Matthew Priddy. Have you got a social
handle? Fraser Smith Historics.
And what would the car crowd be?
We're at the car crowd UK across everything, YouTube, Twitter, etc.
So please go follow, and thank you very much for joining us.